Spidulf is a psychologist and author best known for his very popular parenting books, Raising Boys and Raising Girls. His latest book takes on a bigger subject, the human race in general. Steve Spidulf says humans have a kind of super sense, often called gut instinct, which we need to learn how to tap into in order to become, in his words, fully human. He says the super sense can offer us daily guidance on all manner of decisions if we pay attention, from big calls such as whether to leave a relationship to whether to have that second cup of coffee. And by learning to read our bodies, emotions and brains, we can all become more present, steady and calm. This isn't airy-fairy stuff. It is based in science. And Steve Spidulf will explain from his home in Tasmania. Welcome back, Steve. Good to talk.
Hello, Catherine, and hello to your listeners.
When you talk about gut instinct, we think of it as almost being metaphorical. It's not. It's physiological. What's the physiology of it, Steve?
Yes, this is something that's just being really explored for the first time in neuroscience. And the way that it works is that there are we have two halves to our brain. And you and I are talking now on the radio. And so we're using our left hemisphere of our brain and the cortex right at the front. But the other hemisphere over on the other side is the one that looks after the big picture. And so it's taking in the whole environment around us, and it's basically looking for anything that doesn't quite fit with our lifetime of memories. So, for example, a car that's driving erratically, or something that perhaps one of your children had just a funny look on their face this morning and there wasn't time to ask them about it. It takes in all those other things. And if there's something that doesn't quite add up, then it signals the amygdala, which is the alarm system in the middle of our brain. And these are all, in a way, they're primitive systems, but they're actually very sophisticated and very, very fast. But they can't talk to us, Catherine. They can't sort of call out, hey, you know, notice this. And so what they do, they send a signal down through the vagus nerve, which runs right down the middle of our body, to our heart, to our stomach and to our intestines and a whole lot of other places. And we get a twinge, or we get a little empty feeling. And so, if you're listening to me right now, interviewing me here on the radio, and the people listening at home, if you go down the middle of your body, Catherine, and just notice what's happening there, there's always some sensations happening. And they'll be to do with, is this chap talking sense, or is this a load of rubbish, or should I have gone to the toilet before the interview? Or it could be anything. But it's running a constant kind of quality control on everything. And so if you listen to that, then often it gives you really important information. And if you'd like, I can give you some examples of people using that in their lives, which have made a lot of difference.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, perhaps the most vivid example was a lady who was a patient of mine, young mother, in the 1980s, and she was a young mum and also a GP, and she was in a train station car park around the middle of the day and just going from the train to get back in a car to drive home, and a young man called out to her from across the car park, and he was wearing very well dressed. He had a suit and tie. He looked very clean cut and nice looking young chap. And he was about maybe 300 meters away, and he was calling something out, and she couldn't quite hear what he was saying. And she, her conditioning, her nature was to be always to be polite to people and to be helpful. And he was coming closer, and somewhere though, she sort of, most of her was thinking, I'll just go and find out what the poor man wants. Maybe he's lost or something. But somewhere in the pit of her stomach, a little twinge happened. And she told me about this experience. She felt sudden panic in her body, and she jumped in her car, locked the door, and she basically screamed out of there off down the road to home. And when she got home, her kids were waiting and she was pretty busy, and that she put it out of her mind, although she kind of was still a bit rattled, what's wrong with me? What's going wrong? That night on the evening news, the headline story, as she settled down to watch the news, was that a young man had assaulted a young woman in the same car park and had been caught, luckily had been caught, And her husband came in and found her sobbing on the couch because she had put together that it had been a serious assault and that had almost been her. And she was my patient because she was having, a couple of years later, still having a lot of post-traumatic stress from that. And part of her rebuilding her mental health, which is what we're all on about with this new book, is how to put yourself back together again, was to realize that she had very good instincts and she had listened to them against what her actual feelings were. She'd listened to something deeper down and it had very likely saved her life. And so it doesn't have to be as dramatic as that, but does that kind of make sense, Catherine?
Oh, it just makes sense. The gut instinct, and we all feel that physical response when we feel fear or we are thinking something's not quite right here or what do I make of that person. We're all conscious of physiological responses. Your point is that's just not the brain saying, oh, something's up here necessarily. Your point is the response is actually ahead of the brain. The physiological response is ahead of the cognition of working out what might be wrong here.
Yes,
yeah?
That's exactly right. And in that it's incredibly fast. And sometimes we can be very slow, Catherine. There was another person, a friend of mine, who was when she was married in her 20s, and about 6 months into her marriage, she began to have headaches of a migraine type of headache, which she had for 20 years. And then one day, now in her early 40s, she discovered that her husband had been having an affair for the entire period of that they'd been married, that he had a mistress as well as her. And quite understandably, she booted him out. The marriage ended. The amazing thing was that she stopped having those headaches and has never had them ever since. And so we can only surmise about that. These are very hard things to study or to know about, but that somewhere inside her, she had known something wasn't right and that there was a tension between her conscious mind and something her body was picking up. And as soon as that was resolved, then she didn't have headaches anymore. And so we can be a long time waking up to what these things are telling us. And many of my patients have, you know, Vietnam veterans and people like that. We didn't really make any progress until we got down to what is that thing that's always there in your stomach, that's always been there as long as you can remember, or that feeling around, that clench around your heart, and really sort of in a safe setting, go in there and almost ask it questions, Catherine, sort of say to it, is it this? And sometimes your body sensations will kind of soften when you guess the right thing, or they'll turn into a shudder. In my own experience, we talk about this in the book. We had a miscarriage, which I kind of went into a very shut down state. And it was only when I started playing a song on my guitar one afternoon that the tears began to come. And so, typical man, I just bottled it all up. But the song was called Ruby Tuesday, which is a song by the Rolling Stones. Perhaps some of your listeners will remember that song. And the first words are, goodbye, Ruby Tuesday, who could hang a name on you? And when I played those chords and sang those words, I just suddenly was bawling my eyes out because I hadn't really realized that it was in my mind somewhere down there, this miscarriage was a daughter that I'd really wanted. But I didn't know that. It took the pieces of my mind to kind of put themselves together to heal.
The science, again, that you allude to in the book is that deep in the brain, the hippocampus is checking every sensory input, but it checks against our memories and our experiences. And this is your point. This sense or intuition or sixth sense or gut instinct is different from what you are consciously doing. And it's also different from your emotions. It may relate to your emotions, but it is simply more primal. And so what is it that you are telling people to do that instead of putting something to one side or instead of feeling discomfort but thinking no more of it, you do ask questions of it?
Yes, that's really sums it up well. It's almost like our mind is like a It has an architecture to it. And so it's got different, it's like a four-story house. And we need to go down and visit all the floors and turn all the lights on. Because really important, that's just reminded me, Catherine, that question is that in this sometimes gut feelings are wrong. It's not an infallible sense. A Vietnam veteran that I knew in Coffs Harbour had been going pretty well, but then he started having massive anxiety attacks out of the blue. And it turned out that when we tracked it down, a Vietnamese family had moved to live in his street. We had a lot of Vietnamese refugees arrive in Australia, and a young family had come to live a few houses away. And his body just reacted like he was back over there, and it's a sort of the fear and the danger that he'd been in came back. Now, because he was able to get a handle on that, and it wasn't rocket science to work that out, he did a brilliant thing. He went and visited that family and said, you know, I just live up the street, just wanted to say hi. And in the end, he got to know them really well. And his amygdala was completely reassured that they were safe and friendly, and he was perfectly fine. And in the end, he even took a step further and he went back to Vietnam and visited so that he could re-educate his nervous system out of those primal kind of fears. And so if he hadn't done that, he would have just been, you know, having gut feelings telling him he was in terrible danger all the time, which just wasn't true. And so yes, you're right. You don't take gut feelings as necessarily being right, but it's like you should always listen to them.
We are constantly reconciling our primal brain, the lizard brain. Our wonderful expert here now, Nathan Wallace, refers to it too. He focuses very much on child and adolescent development. But we have the strange contradiction of having ancient parts to our brain and then this very sophisticated frontal cortex that turned up later. That's extraordinarily sophisticated. And when the two are out of kilter, we can feel a dissonance or a discomfort. I want to talk a little bit more about how you talk about reconciling the two and how you question what your gut is telling you, but you can't identify it, and or perhaps you're avoiding it. There's an interesting part where you refer to, ask questions, but and you say it'll respond in a microsecond. Breathe, slow down, don't overload me. How do we learn to live with and work with the more primal part of our brains, and particularly if this is not necessarily a quick fix sometimes, these feelings that we have, as it probably wasn't for your Vietnam veteran?
No, that's right. You have to sort of keep shuttling between the floors, going up and down. And my favourite instance, and this is for anyone who's raising kids, this is a very practical thing that you can do, was a teenage girl, Genevieve, who was 16 years old and had a very nice boyfriend that she'd been going out with for about 6 months, and it was young love and it was really nice in her life. But just in the last few weeks, this boy had been starting to put pressure on her to have sex, and maybe he'd got this, kids were teasing him about, you haven't done it or not, or some stupid stuff that boys get into. But he was starting to really kind of intrude into their relationship. And Genevieve went and talked to her mum, because she was close to her mum and could talk about this kind of stuff. And her mum said, well, how do you feel about it? And Genevieve said, I just don't know, mum. I'm really confused because I love him. He's the best. But she said, I just don't know. That's, and then her mum said something which was kind of like a Pulitzer Prize of questions, which was, she said, well, listen, honey, sometimes your body knows what's right for you. When your mind is in a complete spin, your body sometimes sends you signals and tells you what is best. And Genevieve, in a flash, said, "Oh," she said, "I know exactly what you mean. It's 1 minute we're kissing and cuddling, on a in a bus stop somewhere, and I feel brilliant. I feel really, but when he comes on too strong, I feel squashed. I feel hurried. I don't want to have sex with him, Mum. And bang, out it came. And so, in a way, this, can you see what had happened there, Catherine? That her mum had kind of guided her down to where the level where she did know what she wanted. And we teach this to little children now. We teach them, if you feel squirmy in your tummy around somebody, you don't feel right, you know, go and tell somebody. It's a really quite a good way of finding out, because it's not a primitive system at all. It's not really a lizard brain. It's a kind of a wild panther brain, which was, you know, for millions of years kept us very safe in very complex environments. And it's such a resource, and it actually, we can build back our whole mental health if we can just get those levels to stack up.
A big part of the premise of this book is that we have lost touch with our gut instinct. And in part, you argue that's to do with what happened with generations during the 20th century. I'm curious about this. You've got quite a strong theme of the generation that came out of war and did not want to share and did not like exhibitions of feelings or bringing up things. Now, can you explain a little bit more about what you think has happened, how that's moved from one generation to the next, and how we need to repair it?
Yes, that's such a good question. That when basically the masculinity of the 20th century and even earlier was shaped around war, and that we were interested in raising cannon fodder of the wars of empire, and so our masculinity was all about toughing it out. And so basically a whole generation of men went away to two world wars, which were like two hammer blows intergenerationally. And if you'd seen friends blown to pieces on the battlefield and very explicitly told to put it out of your mind, have a drink, you know, soldier on. When those men came back, they were often very shut down. And if you imagine a dad who's gone through those kinds of things and he's just with his little five-year-old son, and his little son has, you know, perhaps his pet rabbit has died or something, or his best friend is moving to another school. And that little boy's telling his, you know, standing there looking at that dead rabbit in the cage, and the little boy starts to cry. When the dad sees the little boy crying, the nature of our feelings is we feel with people close to us. So the dad starts to experience the grief in him as he sees the grief in his child. But his body thinks, if I start crying, I will never stop. And that's, many men have told me, that's their feeling about it. You know, my feelings are just so huge that I just go mad. Now, that's not true. Of course, you don't go mad from crying. But the dad just automatically feels so uncomfortable that he says something really heartless to the boy, like, you know, grow up or get over it. We'll get you another rabbit, or, you know, or even worse, in the 20th century, probably clips him across the ear or something like that. And so those things get passed on. And our own emotional range is often just within what was allowed in our family we're growing up. That some families allow a lot of anger and some allow none at all. And some allow some sadness or none at all. And once I won a fellowship to study in the United States. And I rang my mum and I said, Mum, I'm really excited. And Mum said, don't get too excited. it was pretty squished. I said, you know, why not, Mum? You know, what happens if you get too excited? And we joked about it because that was her Yorkshire. Yeah, I grew up in Yorkshire, which was the world capital of negative parenting. And so we had a little laugh about it, but it was straight out of her childhood and she couldn't stop it coming out of her mouth. Am I making sense?
Yes, you are. I'm curious as to your take, because we have a very anxious young generation. There are some very obvious reasons why. They're probably the most exposed, in a way, generation to the most observed and you know,
yes,
judged and trying to fit in at an age where you shouldn't have to fit in anywhere, frankly. But we talk a lot about how to help them, and we talk a lot about building resilience and these kinds of things. And at this stage of your long career now as a psychologist, how do you come at how we help to help come to help this generation which has inherited a whole new set of complications.
Yes. Well, first, I really hate the term resilience, Catherine, and we haven't got time to go into why, but it could, because it puts all the blame onto the person. But what I think is that, you see, our mind was, we have a wild creature mind. And we human beings lived in groups of about 20 people who all loved each other. And we were a clan, and we were multi-generational, and we were very, very close and cooperative. And our feelings, and especially for the women who were the most skilled at cooperating, was to be able to know everyone in that 20 people, if someone was out of sorts or something was not quite right, to be conscious of that. And that's a beautiful skill, the sensitivity to people around us. The trouble is now is our daughters in particular are on, about half of them have been found to be on the internet after midnight most nights. And you're out there with thousands of people who don't give a damn about your mental health. In fact, some of them are out to destroy it. And so we just haven't put the protections around. We've taken that beautiful wild creature that all of us are and exposed them to this nightmarish tsunami of hate and judgment. And no wonder that wild creature is absolutely climbing the walls. And so sometimes we've just got to say, look, this is the kind of being a human being is. You need some, what you need, four or five good friends, and that's it. Don't have your mental ecosystem online. Don't have devices in bedrooms. Live as close as you can to nature. Always have animals in your house if you possibly can. Have a dog or a cat. Have pot plants. New Zealand is a wonderful place to raise children because nature is always within sight. You can always get to nature. And these are the things that mean that your country's mental health is significantly better than a lot of other places. But we shouldn't forget that or take it for granted.
Goodness, we have real issues with mental health here, Steve, and that's the problem. You can have all the potential in the world, but humans are humans, and when they are treated badly or where they succumb to what is being pushed at them, and that sounds again like a judgmental term, because it's almost inevitable, then it takes its toll, and it is taking its toll. Steve Bidoff is our guest, Fully Human, A New Way of Using Your Mind is his latest book, talking about tapping into the ancient gut instinct that can provide so much guidance when we check out what is going on with it. 10:30 it is. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. You are also very open in this book, more open than you've been perhaps previously, about your own feelings, about things that have happened in your life. And you also talk about an informal diagnosis of Asperger's that a colleague made for you. How much have you learned at this, you know, after all these decades, how much have you learned of late about yourself, and how are you applying that knowledge to your own well-being and your own mental health?
Yes, well, a huge amount, Catherine. I was 55 when my a psychiatrist friend sat me down and said, Steve, you do realise you're on the autism spectrum and quite a way along. And it was like all the dominoes fell. It was like something like finding out your mum was always an alcoholic or something, and you just never knew. And all of a sudden, everything just makes sense. But in a way, it was the wound that turned to gold, Catherine, because I'd always had to think about how to relate to people. I had a pretty rough adolescence, but I two lucky things happened. One, I chose psychology as a career, and the other was that I married Sharon, my wife, who has incredible emotional intelligence for some reason. And so those two things together, I gradually learned. I learned that there's things called feelings, and they show on a person's face, and it's a good idea to keep an eye on those. And that conversation is like a tennis match. You let them hit the ball back to you. You don't just keep talking. And so when somebody said, will you write a book about autism, Steve? I said, I think all my books, Secret of Happy Children, Raising Boys, and now Fully Human, they're all about having a mental map of how to navigate your mind. and how to navigate relationships, because that's what I needed to do that. And now the super sense idea is a very new one. I've only been doing that since about 12 months as I was writing and researching it. But I'm already finding I'm much, much calmer. Because with Asperger's, you tend to go into a social panic and you talk too quickly. But I keep going back to that wild creature down inside me, and it's saying, like, can I just breathe, you know? And what you can do is the architecture of your mind, you think, okay, up to feelings, what's happening there? Up to thinking, how's that going? And up to the top floor, which we haven't mentioned yet, which is spirituality. And that is the part that is very at ease in the world, who thinks I'm just a little leaf on the tree of the human race, and soon I'll fall from my twig, and that's okay. There's more leaves, and that's only one tree in the forest anyway. And so you take yourself a little lightly, and feel sort of at ease in your own skin and at ease in the world. And so, if people listening think about everyone they've ever met, that. Sometimes you meet people who are really, really together, and they're very, very calm, and they're caring, and you feel good around them. If you think about what that is, it's because all their levels stack up. What they're doing with their body, what their emotions are, what their thinking is, and their spirituality are all lined up, all the way down. Whereas most of us, our levels are all pulling in different directions. And so if you want to really improve your life, then don't worry about that I have to be consistent or I have to add up. It'll take care of itself. If you just keep shifting down to your heart, you know, perhaps, you know, you're worried about a sick child, or you had a car accident or something, and go down there and let those feelings flow, let them come, let them wash through your body. Go up into your head and say, am I making sense here? Am I kidding myself? Robert Bly says you should write a journal every morning. And someone said, why go to that trouble? He said, because it's really hard to lie to yourself in writing. And you can spot your own, you know, your own bullshit, basically, when you write it down. And so by shuttling up and down the four layers, gradually they will start to pull themselves into line. And you might find you decide, look, I really don't like the childcare who's looking after my child, or this job is not good for me, or this friend is not, just, I never ever come away from them feeling better. And so when you will find you've got this very good guidance system. Now my super sense is telling me I'm waffling on here, Catherine.
So, making sense. It's a wonderful way to finish. Thanks very much, Steve Biddulph. Fully Human, the new book, A New Way of Using Your Mind. It is published by Penn Macmillan Australia.